This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. You might know our first guest, Buzz Bissinger, as the author of a recent cover story in Vanity Fair about Caitlyn Jenner, the transgender woman who was formerly Olympic athlete Bruce Jenner. Or you might have seen a provocative piece Bissinger wrote about his unusual shopping addiction to expensive designer clothes, especially tight-fitting leather. We'll get to that in a bit. But Buzz Bissinger is best known for his first book, Friday Night Lights, a look at the town of Odessa, Texas, and its obsession with its powerhouse high school football team, the Permian Panthers. ESPN called it the best sports book in the past quarter century. Friday Night Lights became a bestseller, then a movie, then a TV series. For a 25th anniversary edition, Buzz revisited some of the players he profiled in the book, now middle-aged men, to see how they fared after the glory days of high school football. Buzz Bissinger shared a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting in the 1980s. He's currently a contributing editor to Vanity Fair and the author of five books, including Father's Day, an account of his cross-country drive with his special needs son, Zach. I should note that while we aren't close friends, I've known Buzz for many years, since we were both journalists in Philadelphia. Here's our conversation. Well, Buzz Bissinger, welcome to Fresh Air. You wrote Friday Night Lights a long time ago. You were a newspaper reporter in Philadelphia. What made you want to go and spend a year in Odessa, Texas?
Well, I think it really hit. I was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard and had some time off from the Philadelphia Inquirer and went across the country with a friend. And you take the southern route. You go through Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and then ultimately into Texas. And that's where it hit me, because you went through all these little towns and they were dead economically. They had dried up. Everything was shuttered. And then you come to the high school football stadium and they were beautiful, immaculate, you know, and I mean this, they would water the field in a drought. And it just called to me and I said, these aren't just stadiums. These are shrines. These are temples. These are palaces to people's hopes and dreams.
And you moved out there with your family, spent a year at Odessa Permian High School, which had a legendary football program. I knew of Odessa Permian. I grew up in South Texas, hundreds of miles away back then, but I remember hearing about that team. Tell us some of the ways that you could see how obsessed Odessa was about the Permian Panthers.
Well, I remember driving. It was on Grandview Avenue, and I'm heading north. And, you know, Odessa's just kind of a dusty, gritty place. And I'm wondering, God, do I really want to live here for a year? And I see that stadium. And this is 1988. This stadium was built in 1985. And it's like a rocket ship on the desert. Seats 19,000 people. Artificial surface field. Absolutely beautiful. And then I heard, you know, some games, they get 22,000. Then I heard that they preempted a National League baseball playoff game because the Permian Midland League game was put on television. And on it went.
And when the team would travel from the school to the stadium, they, yeah.
When they would travel, you know, from the school to the stadium, there was a caravan of police cars. You would have thought it was the president, basically. A caravan of police cars because, you know, they need to be accompanied, you know, by the police. They pull into the stadium. Inevitably, people would be there, you know, cheering for them. And by the way, when they flew to certain away games, particularly Texas is a big state, charter jet. I'm not talking commercial jet. I'm talking chartered jet. And I think the year I was there, it cost about $60,000.
Mostly paid for by boosters, these rich
paid, guys. Paid for boosters. And then I think the school kicked in some money. You know, more money was spent on getting rushed game tapes so they would get them that Saturday overnight than that was spent on books and supplies for the English department.
Now, you kind of embedded with the team for a year and floated through the high school, spent a lot of time with players and their friends, and you profile several of the players in the book, and we get a very rich sense of who they are. And, you know, teenagers, and especially teenage boys, aren't exactly self-aware. Did you get them to talk about their lives, what the game meant to them, or did you pick that up more from observation?
You know, it took a while. I mean, look, I'm from the East Coast. I grew up in New York. I was working at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I lived a life of ridiculous privilege. So it took a while. I mean, I basically show up in a gray tweed jacket with elbow patches and loafers. So they looked at me like, this guy is from Mars. Who the hell is this guy? But I found, and this is why I embedded, not for just the season, for a year. This is why I brought my family, my 2 5-year-old boys, Jerry and Zach, with me, and my then fiance. I was part of that town. I was there every day. I went to every practice. Although journalistically, there's nothing more boring than practice after the first 2 days. I went to every early morning practice because they would practice on the school stage at 7 in the morning. And bit by bit, the kids said, you know, this guy is for real. This guy is really doing it. And I got to tell you, once you got them to open up, they opened up. I mean, that's why I love Texans, because they have big personalities. And after a while, you know, I really didn't have to squeeze it out.
One of the things that I was aware of growing up in South Texas, where I don't think football was as big as it was at Odessa Permian, but it was big. And I observed the football players in high school who were stars had trouble afterwards because they weren't stars anymore. They had to face real life. These guys had the pressure of being in a terrific football program and then being profiled in a book and all. Did it change their lives? I mean, did they feel like their lives had ended when they graduated?
I think it changed their lives. For a lot of kids, life peaks at 18 in Odessa. It just does. You're playing in front of 19,000 people. You're the god of the town. You're a rock star, but you know, you don't spend the rest of your life being that kind of star. And for a lot of these players, there's sort of this glazed look on their eyes saying, what happened? What happened to the crowds? What happened to the attention? Because no one is more lonely and isolated than a former player who comes back to the locker room. You know, there's a pat on the back and the coach says, hey, it's great to see you, man. But then no one cares. Nobody cares. And they get shell-shocked. Having said that, I think it did change their lives. I think, frankly, like me, for a period of time, they got sick of it. They were tired of hearing about it. You know, the book comes out, and then the film catapults them even more. And I think there was resentment. One of the players, Ivy Christian, I felt there was a lot of resentment. But I think, like me, you know, because I'm 60, they're now in their 40s, I think they're beginning to embrace it more, that, you know what, this is amazing that I played football and that it's been documented and chronicled in this way. And I say that having, you know, recently seen them, and I hope I'm right.
At the heart of the story, I mean, one of the central figures of the book is an African-American running back named Booby Miles. Tell us about him, you know, what his promise was and what happened in that season.
I mean, to me, I think Booby is the prime example of how many boobies there are in the world of sports. Kids, particularly African-American kids, who people only believe in because of their ability to play football or basketball. Having said that, Booby was basically treated as a football animal. He was pushed through school without any demands. He basically had a tutor who gave them the answer to all the questions. There was no attempt to educate him at all. And tragically, I never saw him play because in a preseason scrimmage, in a silly play that was meaningless, his cleat got caught in the turf. He blew out his knee. He played like 6 plays the whole season. Booby lived for football. He was told to live for football. His uncle, who took care of him, he lived for football. That was his only persona in school. And when he lost that, I saw him dissolve. I saw him fall apart. I saw every dream he had fall to pieces. And I saw that town, and I will never take this back, I saw that town turn totally against him after loving him and extolling him when they found another running back who was good or maybe better named Chris Comer. And that's when the N-word came out, a big, dumb old N. And that was a coach. That was an assistant coach who's a nice guy. That was an assistant coach. And I heard boosters laughing one day in the sidelines and sort of comparing Booby to a horse. What do you do when a horse is pulled up lame? You shoot him. You shoot him. And I saw this over and over. And I've kept in touch with Booby since the book in 1990 for 25 years, and I don't think he's ever, 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 ever recovered. And the last time I saw him, it's in the afterword, the new afterword, the last time I saw him was wearing a white prison uniform. And I think collectively, because of the way we view sports and the way we view African Americans, we all bear responsibility.
Tell us a little more about what he's done in the last 25 years and what he looked like. I mean, he was a terrifically fit athlete when you first saw him.
Terrific. When I first saw Boobie, I mean, Boobie was a man among the boys. I mean, he was perfectly proportioned. He was 200 pounds, 6'2", tough, liked to hit, and ran like the wind. I think he ran about a 10-200. And I saw tapes of him, and he would just fly. He would run with such joyful abandon. It was so exquisite to watch. Now, would he have made it to the pros? Probably not. Would he have made it to a major college? I don't know. He didn't have the academics. But he loved that game. And when it was taken away, he knocked around at some junior colleges. He had a knee brace. It was totally clear that he had lost that millimeter of speed. He was no longer that good and basically spent much of his life, the past 25 years, knocking around. Menial jobs, no stability, impatience, and I believe still saying to himself, I should have been a star. I should have been a star. And when the movie came out in 2004, it was the worst kind of celebrity. Because Boobie's now being asked for autographs at the local mall. A lot of people know who Boobie is. There's a rap song called Boobie Miles that is made. But he's getting nothing.
You're talking about when the movie came out in 2005, was
right.
It? Yeah.
2004. And as I say, when the movie came out in 2004, you know, he was put on this false, ridiculous pedestal of celebrity. He's being asked for autographs. Now he's being sued by women who claim, that he was the father of their child. There are rap songs, being made about him. And he got nothing. He got $1,000 from the film producers. $1,000. I supplemented it, not because I'm a great person. I supplemented it a lot. I could not forget what he had been through, and I felt a tremendous amount of guilt. But ultimately, it just didn't work. He was convicted of aggravated assault. He got a 10-year suspended sentence. Then he was picked up on a probation violation and is now in prison with an eligibility of parole in 2017.
You bought him a car at one point, tried to help him get into school. Did it make a difference in his life?
It made no difference, and I realized that the danger of getting a car was fine, but paying for school and HVAC, he went. He didn't do anything with it. I gave him lump sums. I wrote an e-book called After Friday Night Lights that was about Boobie, and we split the proceeds. It was fine with me. He got a lot of money, and I realized, and he said this, it's in the afterword. You know, when I got that amount of money, I went crazy with it. I went to strip joints, possibility of drugs. I mean, here's this money, and I didn't have the discipline. And I realized it wasn't helping him. It wasn't giving him a sense of responsibility. And what Boobie really needed was someone in his life basically on a daily basis. And I couldn't be that person. I mean, I loved him as a son, but I'm not that person. I have three kids of my own. So it really did not help.
In addition to being a writer, you're an interesting character, Buzz.
I suppose you would know that, actually.
I would know that. We know each other a bit. But, I mean, you're an interesting media figure. I mean, you've had a wildly entertaining and at times angry and profane Twitter feed.
Right.
You've certainly had some interesting television appearances. And for many years, you've been writing for Vanity Fair. And a couple of years ago, you wrote a really shockingly honest piece about what you call your Gucci addiction, an obsession with buying expensive designer clothes, particularly leather. You want to give us a sense of how deeply you were into this, the hold it had on you?
The hold was enormous, like any addiction is, and make no mistake about it, it was a shopping addiction because, it's a shopping addiction, but it's a sexual addiction. It's like any addiction. In my case, it was leather. I have a leather fetish, which is fine, but my shopping became compulsive. I had to get packages, and it's much better but it's still there. 3-4 packages a day. I bought a lot of women's clothing. And you know what? I like women's clothing. I've cross-dressed. I like cross-dressing. My wife knows it. My kids know about it. But I would buy two of the same thing. I bought a lot of boots. I bought stiletto boots. I bought leather jackets. I had over 100 leather jackets and probably close to 100 pairs of leather pants. I mean, in your lifetime, you probably can't wear all that stuff. I spent over $500,000. My life was falling apart. I was very, very unhappy. I cheated on my wife, Lisa, who somehow has stood by me, and our marriage is great now. She left. I was playing around with Percocet. I was miserable. I wanted to destroy myself. And I think writing this very honest story, although I believe much of what I said in it, was frankly, that was the way to ultimately destroy myself, because I knew that it would have terrible impact on Lisa and in particular my children, who did not know about the story before it came out.
There's a lot in there in what you just said. And why don't we just start with what you think drove this? You said it was not just a shopping addiction, but sexual.
Sexual in the sense that, you know, leather has become kind of a sexual icon to me. And, you know, the reason why I became obsessed with it at a very young age, I had a difficult relationship with my mother, who always wore leather gloves. There was a teacher in kindergarten who wore leather gloves and thought I was stupid. So I fixated on that and I tried to repress it. And I did not wear a stitch of leather until I was 40 years old. I was very good at repressing things. And then I began when I was 40. And in my 50s, it became completely out of control. It was a complicated sexual addiction. That was the diagnosis when I went into rehab. And it also, I was going through an all-purpose breakdown. I was playing around with S&M by myself, wearing paraphernalia that could be very dangerous, could have killed me. And I didn't really care. I didn't really care. My last book, a very personal book written about my beloved son, Zach, who you know, who was born with a trace brain damage and the complications of that relationship. That bombed. And once that bombed, I didn't care about anything.
You know, you got a lot of attention for a piece that you recently wrote in Vanity Fair about Caitlyn Jenner, the transgender woman formerly Bruce Jenner. And you write in that book about how Bruce Jenner enjoyed wearing his mother's clothes when he was a kid. And do you think you have any gender confusion?
I think I do have some gender confusion, but, you know, actually in doing the Vanity Fair piece on Caitlyn Jenner, I learned a lot about transgender men and women, and I learned a lot about various psychosexual conditions, because I remember asking Caitlyn Jenner, do you get a sexual charge from wearing women's clothing? And he said, no, not at all. I mean, for me, it's, you know, I was born a woman. I happen to be in a man's body, so to speak, but I was born Caitlyn Jenner. For me, it is related to a kind of sexual turn-on. You know, I don't know how else to be but honest. Were there certain times in my life where I wondered, I don't know, maybe I'm a woman, but, you know, I wasn't. I finally realized, Dave, that you should not be dictated by what others think. And, you know, my look has attitude. I think I pull it off really well. Just as I think there are people who look at me when I'm dressed a certain way who say, that guy's out of his mind. But, you know, I don't care. I don't care. Do I have gender confusion? Definitely. And yeah. Am I more open about this because I feel that we should gender bend? I don't know. You know, I mean, who the hell cares? Difference is great. Difference is wonderful. It's very hard to be different in this country. Extremely hard.
You got treatment for the shopping addiction. Was it like AA? Did you have to, like, detox by not shopping for 2 weeks? And then were you in rooms with people who had that kind of addiction or other kinds?
The treatment is very much based on the principles of AA. There's no question about that. People are in there for all sorts of different things. In my case, and trust me when I say the shopping addiction was the least of my problems. But people were in for, you know, they've been molested as children. They were in for, you know, rampant use of prostitutes. People were in for all sorts of different things. The catch-all was sex addiction. And, you know, a lot of it is worked out in group therapy, where a lot of it is the people you're with calling you on things, observing things, challenging you. Basically, for me, rehab, you could not get away with anything. And that's the way for me it has to be. You have to strip yourself bare. And once you strip yourself bare, you build yourself up. And you also learn, and I learned about the source of, to some degree, and I'll never know completely, why I was the way I was.
And do you want to put that into words, the source?
Well, as I said, I mean, I do think, you know, it's like everything in life. It goes back to early childhood. I was terrified of my mother. My mother, I thought, was beautiful. She had a big temper. She was very non-nurturing. She went to work in the 1957 or 56, which was not typical. I'm not sure she really wanted to have kids, although later in life she became a much better and wonderful mother. But I was terrified. But you want to please. I mean, you're a kid. And then, as I said, you know, she's wearing leather gloves. All her life she loved wearing leather gloves. She would wear leather gloves in the spring. And that becomes the talisman. That becomes, you know, the goblet. That becomes my fixation. And it was intensified. I was very shy. I was very withdrawn. I was terrified of life. I was terrified of everything. Of everything. And then I go to kindergarten and I didn't talk. I didn't know what to do. This teacher didn't like me. I think, and I'm not being facetious, she thought something was wrong with me mentally. And, you know, you're humiliated. But in some weird way, you like the humiliation because that's how you get attention. And she's wearing these leather gloves. I mean, I'll never forget it. And that becomes another fixation. And that, I know, became the source of why I was the way it was. And then also, I know the admission of the shopping addiction was just a cover, in a sense, for some deep, deep-seated sexual habits. And I guess the search for an identity that will probably never quite come. But I'm happy. I'm happier. Work is just work. Work for me was always how I identified. What have you done lately? That was always in my household. What have you done lately? What have you done lately? You know, Upper West Side Jewish, very, very, very competitive. The parents are very, very competitive. And there are a lot of people who really excel. So that's another insecurity. And my life was guided by shame. My life was guided by shame. And that's what I learned most of all in rehab.
Buzz Bissinger, we're out of time. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Buzz Bissinger is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. A new 25th anniversary edition of his best-selling book, Friday Night Lights, is out next week. A just-published literary noir called Dragonfish puts a new spin on the old formula. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has fallen hard for this tale of gamblers, dark alleys, and dangerous dames. Here's her review.
In the dead of summer, with the sun beating down, what could be more refreshing than a straight shot of literary noir? After all, noir is the stuff of shadowy landscapes and even shadier characters. It always seems to be raining in noir, even in California. Pick up a copy of, say, Double Indemnity by James M. Cain, or In a Lonely Place by Dorothy B. Hughes, which has been reprinted by the Feminist Press, or watch the film masterpieces that were made from those and other noir classics, and you're sure to feel a soothing darkness closing in. But noir's appeal isn't just nostalgic. It's a form that gets remixed by each new generation of fans and practitioners. Which brings us to Dragonfish, a superb debut novel by Vu Tran that takes the noir basics and infuses them with the bitters of loss and isolation peculiar to the refugee and immigrant tale. Dragonfish opens in Oakland, California, circa the year 2000, where a worn-out white cop, evocatively named Robert Ruin, is still stuck on his ex-wife, Susie, a beautiful Vietnamese woman who's now remarried to a fellow Vietnamese exile, a high-stakes gambler and crime boss operating out of Vegas. As Robert describes her in flashbacks, Susie was always a strange one, a woman plagued by nightmares whose idea of home decoration was to hang crucifixes in every room. Robert should have known Susie was femme fatale trouble from the get-go. They met when he was called in to investigate a robbery at the florist shop where Susie then worked. As he recalls, "When I arrived, she stood at the door with a baseball bat in one hand and bloody pruning shears in the other. I understood about a quarter of what she said, but I knew I liked her. We found the perp 2 miles away, limping and bleeding from a stab wound to his thigh. The pruning shears had done it. Susie and I married 4 months later." But that's all in the past, right? Except that the past is never past in noir. It turns out that Susie has recently deserted her crime boss husband, whose name is Sonny, and he wants her back. With the help of an incriminating video that shows Robert doing things that could cost him his badge, Sonny strong-arms Robert to track down the woman they both find unforgettable. The plot of Dragonfish, like every respectable noir, is as tangled as a set of sweaty bedsheets in a no-tell motel. There are nods to noir classics like Gilda and Vertigo in this novel, but Tran also puts his own special stamp on the genre, particularly through the way he intersperses stories about the rootlessness of his Vietnamese characters and the immigrant American dream gone rancid. We get snatches of hollow-voiced letters and journal entries written by Susie, dating back to the time she spent in a refugee camp in Malaysia after the fall of Saigon. When Robert drives to Las Vegas to track down Susie, he enters shabby, Rat Pack-era casinos staffed by a new wave of washed-up dreamers. Here's his description of a joint called the Coronado. "I wandered through the throng of afternoon gamblers, hunched over table games amid a cigarette haze. Nearly every dealer I passed was Chinese, Filipino, Vietnamese. I wondered how many of them had actually come from somewhere far away, and how many were right at home." But nobody's right at home here. Even the weather is out of place. Just as in the L.A. of Chandler and Kane, where it's always raining, there's a freak snowstorm in Las Vegas at the end of Tran's novel. Noir has always been a nightmare genre about displacement, about people and things fated to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some of the greatest noir film directors, like Billy Wilder and Fritz Lang, were themselves refugees, in their case fleeing from Hitler's Germany. In Dragonfish, Vu Tran has given us a haunting literary noir about a newer generation of refugees and immigrants who find themselves lost in America.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Dragonfish by Vu Tran. If you wanted to find our next guest, Susan Casey, the first place you'd probably look is in the water. She spends a lot of time on the ocean, where she researched a best-selling book about sharks and another about huge ocean waves, and her latest about the remarkable lives and abilities of dolphins. Dolphins are marine animals of great intelligence and physical ability who've been known to come to the rescue of humans at sea in some pretty surprising circumstances. And Casey writes they strike a deep emotional chord in most people who encounter them. In her new book, she shares some fascinating research about dolphins and describes new threats they face, from organized dolphin kills to man-made sounds in the ocean that wreak havoc with the animal's highly sensitive echolocation systems. Susan Casey's work has appeared in Sports Illustrated, Outside, National Geographic, and other publications. Her books include The Devil's Teeth, about sharks, and The Wave. Her latest book is Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. Well, Susan Casey, welcome to Fresh Air. So let's talk about these animals. Where do they come from in the evolutionary chain?
They are such old animals. The last ancestor that we had in common with them, us being primates, was 95 million years ago. Then at 55 million years ago, they came off the land and went into the ocean. And at the time, when they were land mammals, they looked like apparently small-hooved wolves. So I found that a kind of an interesting combination to begin with. But then these small-hooved wolves slipped into the water and began a completely different evolutionary trajectory. 35 million years ago, their brains changed size dramatically and became much larger. At the same time, their bodies became much smaller, and they developed all the equipment that they needed to live full-time underwater.
You encounter some interesting characters. I mean, dolphins are interesting, and you encounter some interesting characters as you set out to learn more about them. And you look through the files of a researcher named John Lilly. I think he passed away in the early 2000s. Tell us a bit about his work.
His career trajectory was unusual. He started off in a really sort of rigorous scientific way with being a neuroscientist, a commissioned surgeon. He was trained in psychology. And when he saw his first dolphin brain, had found his grail. Here was a big, interesting brain. It was built differently than the human brain, but it was clearly meant serious business. And they were available. These animals were available. This was the 50s. He was able to experiment on dolphin brains in a way that we would find extremely awful. But he started working with dolphins, and within a very short period of time, sort of reeled at how sophisticated, how intelligent, and, you know, how unusual they were. They were always wanting to communicate with him. And that began a phase of his career where he really kind of went off the reservation.
You said that some of his methods would have troubled us today. What did he do to their brains to learn about them?
Well, in the 50s was a pretty rude time for brain research. It was vivisection. It was experimenting on live animals. His first outing with dolphins, he killed 5 dolphins in basically one long session. Because at the time, nobody understood that they don't breathe involuntarily like we do. They take in breath as a decision because they're underwater. They need to be able to time when they breathe. So when you anesthetize a dolphin, you basically are killing it unless you can somehow put in a breathing apparatus. And nobody knew that. So he would try to give them anesthesia or Nembutal, and they would die. And then once they figured that out, actually his method was to hammer steel sleeves into their skulls.
He popularized images of dolphins a lot. I mean, he wrote books which were widely read and developed a public affinity for these animals. But he also got kind of weird. What are some of the other things that he did that were a little more notorious?
Well, it started right at the beginning. He began to throw out a lot of pronouncements about dolphins, that they were most likely more intelligent than we were, that they had all kinds of abilities that could help us. Maybe they could teach us about space. You know, they could certainly be taught to speak English. Once we could speak to them, they would probably do all kinds of stuff for us in the oceans, like bring deep water species up for us to examine and maybe deliver missiles or I mean, he had this whole list of things that we would have dolphins do for us. And unfortunately for Lilly, he didn't really have any scientific proof to back up a lot of his boldest assertions. The real colorful part began when he got a lab in the U.S. Virgin Islands and somehow had oceanfront property with these buildings that were set up to observe dolphins and in some cases flooded, half flooded with water so that humans and dolphins could be them together. And, you know, he just sort of began this wild period of experimentation with dolphins and at some point along the way picked up LSD to try to better commune with the dolphins.
So he would take LSD, and did he give the animals LSD also?
He did. He wrote an entire book about that, and he himself would float in his flotation tank, which he also had invented.
He also had a cohabitation experiment with a woman, Margaret Hout. What was that all about?
whenever I speak about my book, this is always what people want to talk about. Margaret was a very game woman. She believed, like he did, that if you had enough contact with a dolphin, particularly if it was a young dolphin, in the same way that a mother might raise a young child, then you could eventually teach them our language. You could teach them to speak English. And so after a little bit of theory and experimentation, they set up an environment where Margaret lived with a young male dolphin named Peter for 10 weeks in a house that was flooded with 24 inches of salt water. So they were always together, and there was a very strict schedule. There were math lessons, pronunciation, grammar, even manners. And things went sideways pretty quickly in the flooded house. Margaret was made aware very quickly of the dolphin's sort of needs. He began to pursue her sexually.
This is a fascinating part of the story, and I don't know how graphic we want to be, but in the notes, it appears that the dolphin would follow Margaret Howe around, aroused. How did she deal with it?
Well, her notes are, I mean, reading through her notes is, it's both hilarious and horrifying at the same time. And at one point, she writes, "He does not go away." And she italicized it and underlined it. And so she said, "I carry a broom handle with me to ward him off."
And so did we learn something from that or from any of these experiments with, you know, mind-expanding drugs that advanced our understanding of dolphins?
Well, I think, you know, Lily is so fascinating because he's so polarizing. There's something so wonderful about his imagination in terms of what could possibly be going on with an animal that's had a big brain for 35 million years and adapted perfectly in the dominant ecosystem on Earth. Something really cool could be happening in that brain. There is just no doubt about that. And we are just sort of starting to understand more about it. But at the same time, he was pretty freewheeling about the things he did and the things he said. And a lot of scientists believe that he set back research on dolphins quite a long way.
Okay. And now, serious researchers have, you know, documented some pretty remarkable things about these animals and what they can do and learn. For example, language. Tell us about some of that.
One of my favorite facts about dolphins is that they understand syntax in sentences. They understand that if I say, "Take the hoop to the surfboard, then get the ball," it's different than "take the ball to the surfboard, then get the hoop," or any number of complex changes in sentences, any number of quick changes with wording that changes the meaning of a sentence. The dolphins were able to pick that up very quickly. And the experiments that I'm speaking of were done in Honolulu by a scientist named Lou Herman. And these were phenomenal experiments. They took place from around 1980 to the early 2000s. And he was very rigorous. He proved a lot about dolphins being able to understand and communicate to us in ways that Lily hadn't, because he attacked it so rigorously. And he, you know, some of the things that he was able to determine were that they can understand concepts like presence and absence, or they could listen to 8 sounds in a row, and then they would use their flippers to press paddles to say whether yes or no the 9th sound had been played previously. They could discern all kinds of things. When they were asked to innovate, they immediately began to do behaviors that they hadn't done before. They understood what that meant. So there were these subtle conceptual things in language that they understood, and they picked them up fast.
And I love that there was another one where he would ask them to do something that was completely impossible, like take me into the tank or something, and they would just stare back like, what are you kidding me?
Right. When they were given instructions that they could not execute or that were not possible to execute, they wouldn't even try. At the end, I believe they understood something like 2,000 sentences, and you know, and he also noted that when new instructions were given, brand new instructions that they had never heard before, their performance wasn't any different than rote instructions. So they picked up new things quickly as well.
There are some remarkable stories of them coming to the assistance of humans in the ocean. You want to share a couple of them?
My absolute favorite story comes from a scientist who was studying a pod of bottlenose dolphins along the coast of Los Angeles. One gray, foggy morning, she was in her research boat, trailing along as they were just doing their average hunting, looking for fish. And One dolphin broke away and started just swimming at top speed out to sea. The other dolphins followed, and they went for quite a while, and the scientists followed them because it was unusual behavior. You don't see dolphins hunting for fish, finding them, and then taking off very often. So they got about 3 miles out to sea in the fog, and the dolphins had formed a circle. And the scientists looked, and in the center of the circle, there was a young girl floating. She had a plastic bag wrapped around her neck with a suicide note and her ID, and she was very close to dead, but she wasn't dead. And the dolphins had basically led the scientists directly to her, and it was far enough offshore that it was just one of those... How do you explain that?
The girl was saved. The suicide was...
The girl was saved.
Yeah. Some dolphin enthusiasts have some pretty, what would we say, unorthodox views of who they are and what they represent. You went to this place in Hawaii, Dolphinville, where there was an interesting gathering. You want to tell us about that?
Well, Dolphinville is more a state of mind than a place, but it is sort of centered along the Kona coastline, where there's a really regular population of spinner dolphins that come into the bays during the day. And there are a lot of people that come into the water to swim with them because they're pretty reliably found there. And among them is a group of people who sort of loosely refer themselves as Dolphinville, who spend as much time in the water with the dolphins as they can. And they're basically bonded by New Age beliefs about dolphins and that dolphins are sort of highly evolved beings that have messages of wisdom and love and all kinds of different things to teach us. And they gather, they meditate, they swim with the dolphins. And I wanted to go spend some time with them because one of the big questions that I had when I began my reporting was, what is it about dolphins in particular that has so attracted the New Age movement?
It's clear people feel a connection. You have felt that connection in the water. And as you note, some of these folks that you encountered actually believe that they're aliens, right? I mean, there was talk of alien pods under the water, right? What was your reaction to hearing some of these things?
You know, these people are really conscious in the water. I mean, they're actually very respectful and very loving, and, you know, they're not doing anything to harm dolphins whatsoever. So I found it really enchanting to hang out with them. And there were only a few times when I sort of thought, well, that's clear nonsense. If you hang out with these people long enough, you'll hear a lot of talk about, well, maybe the dolphins came from another solar system. They aren't from this planet. Their sonar actually encodes dormant DNA, and they can send messages through it and things like that. They can heal us. There's a lot of that type of belief, and it's, of course, just personal belief, very colorful personal belief that a lot of people have when they come to hang out with Dolphinville.
Dolphins are dying in a lot of places for a lot of reasons. Most dramatically, there are these dolphin kills, which occur in the Japanese village of Taiji and in the Solomon Islands, as you wrote. What are these motivated by, where villagers herd dolphins into shallow pools and kill them?
Well, there's two really different examples. In Taiji, I think it's very clearly motivated by money. It's one of the largest traffickers of live dolphins in the world. And when you go there, you see this sort of small group of fishermen that are rounding up dolphins. It's about a 6 or 7 month hunting season that starts in September in this cove. And of course, it was the cove that was in the movie The Cove, the Oscar-winning documentary. And there are dolphin brokerages, and there's a whale museum there that brokers dolphins for sale to marine parks around the world. There are also a large number of dolphins that are killed and sold for meat. And dolphins are still eaten in Japan, but not a lot. It's not a really popular thing to eat. And it's also very toxic, dolphin meat. It's got a lot of mercury in it. It's got a lot of sort of persistent organic pollutants. Even if you wanted to eat it, it would be very bad for you. So the meat is not a major source of income for the hunt. It's all about selling the dolphins to marine parks. In the Solomon Islands, they're hunting dolphins in a traditional way that they really do have a tradition of hunting dolphins. It's a really rough place, the Solomon Islands, and very poor. And they do eat dolphins there, but they also use the teeth as a currency. The teeth are used to buy brides and, you know, cigarettes and things.
You write about a lot of things that are threats to dolphins, including pollution, including overfishing, which degrades their habitat, and underwater noise, including military sonar. You want to talk a bit about that and why it's so harmful to these animals?
Underwater noise in the ocean is a big, big problem, and it's growing. The good news is there seems to be more awareness of how harmful it is, particularly to animals that live and die by their acoustic senses, like dolphins and whales. And some of the loudest noises are the military combat sonar, which in certain species of dolphins has caused beaching, it's caused hemorrhage of the brain, embolisms. It's killed a lot of dolphins when they're close to it. And in particular, it affects some of the deep water species that it's so loud they end up rushing to the surface. And they're, even though they're very adapted to being at depth, they can still get the symptoms that we would associate with the bends, you know, if you come up too quickly when you're diving. And several environmental groups have taken the Navy to court a couple of times, most recently successfully in California and Hawaii, when the Navy said that they were going to start using the sonar a lot more in that region. And the Navy seems really hesitant to set any precedent about exclusion zones. So this is, when the noise is that loud, military sonar can be as loud as 236 decibels, which is, if we were listening to a sound like that on land, our eardrums would break. It could even cause death. So it's a really painful, loud sound to hear in the water. And of course, sound travels much faster in the water and much farther in the water than it does on land. The only thing that's louder than the military sonar are the air guns that are used for oil and gas prospecting underwater. And those can do all kinds of damage to all the animals underneath them.
Susan Casey, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Susan Casey's book is Voices in the Ocean, A Journey into the Wild and Haunting World of Dolphins. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davis.